Hey everyone, this is Tom Salemi of Device Talks. Welcome back to the Device Talks weekly podcast. We've got an unusual episode for you today. No FOMO this time around, but we will have Paul Grand, the CEO of MedTech Innovator, in the Newmarkers Newsmakers with Chris Newmarker and myself. Then we'll go right to our keynote conversation. I had the great pleasure of speaking with Kelsey Mayo. She's the CEO of Armor Medical. And Armor Medical walked away with the grand prize from MedTech Innovators contest or program where the winner was selected at AdvaMed. So Kelsey and I talked a bit about that and about the big check, but more just about the entrepreneurial journey and this really amazing technology developed by Armor Medical that could have an enormous impact in healthcare. So before we begin, I'd like to invite you to join us at Device Talks Minnesota. The agenda is up. We've got speakers up there as well. Go to minnesota.devicetalks.com to register, to check out the agenda, to check out the speakers. Our keynotes include Heather Knight of Solventum. We'll have Mike Blue of Histosonics. And our closing keynote will be the amazing Lisa Ehrenhardt of Abbott. Looking forward to sitting down and talking with her. So please do go to minnesota.devicetalks.com. to register. All right. Without any further delay, let us get this podcast started. All right. You ready for this?
Ready.
Chris Newmarker, how are you, sir?
Doing well, Tom. Doing well. Though, man, you've been like digging out there in New England.
It's been a sad week. I was seasonally affected on Monday morning. The storm really, I've hit my limit. I did make a point of going out on Tuesday for a snowshoe and get some sun on my face.
I saw that on LinkedIn.
And it did brighten my mood, Chris. Nice. But then we snowed again on Wednesday, and I was sad again. So I'm just taking
vitamin D, man.
I probably should. You're right. I absolutely should.
It's a good Minnesota survival skill. I started taking vitamin D all the time after I moved here.
Do you have a sun lamp? Kayleen Brown got a sun lamp because she's in the Pacific Northwest.
And I have a neighbor who does too. He likes to like wake up and sun himself and get that vitamin D. There we go.
Well, speaking of sunshine, we've got a of sunshine, yes. In the booth with us today.
A blast of sunshine. This is fantastic.
Paul Grand of MedTech Innovator. Paul, you know a little bit about sunshine being where you live, don't you?
I do indeed. I have to say it was really difficult. I took my sweater out last night and braved the walk around UCLA in the 65 degree weather. It was
cold,
really
cold. 65 yeah, degrees.
You know, but you know, you got to do it sometimes. So, I was in New York 3 weeks ago, and there for some of the coldest weather I've ever experienced in my life. So, I have a lot of empathy for you right now, Tom and Chris. So, anyways, great to see you guys.
Good to see you too.
Yeah, great to have you. You're going to be part of our Newmarkers Newsmakers. But before we roll into the news, Paul, you've got some news from the MedTech Innovator Machine. What's going on with you folks?
The MedTech Innovator Machine. I like that.
First of all,
apologies for my voice if it's a little rough this morning. I started losing my voice yesterday, but I've been saving it up entirely for this podcast. I have said, I think, two words this entire day. So these are all for you. Paul Grand here from MedTech Innovator, from the MedTech Innovator Machine, which I'm now going to coin after Tom. thank you for that. MedTech Innovator, for those of you who don't know, is an accelerator for really the best med tech companies on the planet. And this year, we had 1,830 companies apply for this next cycle.
Wow.
Which is astounding, even for us. It's another like 23% increase over last year. So for anybody who thinks innovation is dead, it is not. There's at least 1,830 companies out there that just applied to us. So the news is not that. The news is that we are finalizing selections as we speak for the top 200, it's actually going to be more like 180, but top 200 of those who get invited to pitch at our events that are coming up in the next few months. And for any of you who've never been at one of our pitch events, this is very different. This is not like sitting there and somebody stands in front of the room and they present for 5 minutes and everybody claps and then they walk out of the room and then everybody goes, oh, that thing is never going to work. This is something where we sit around with the leadership of the entire industry. So the strategics, the investors, the clinicians, regulators, well, people from FDA, from CMS, from AMA, we'll have like everybody who matters, is the way I like to put it, in the room. We'll have hundreds of people.
Your board and your judges are a who's who of the top companies in the industry.
Thank you, Chris. I agree. They are the who's who. We should coin that too. The who's who of the med tech industry.
Yeah. Let's start giving him free stuff, Chris. Let's hold back.
I like trademarks. So we'll do that. So that who's who of the med tech industry.
Tom's like, that's my show. No, that's what we do.
I like it. And we'll be bringing all those people together to evaluate the top startups. So we'll have literally hundreds of the who's who, the people who matter in med tech, evaluating the top startups in the industry. There's nothing like it in the world. That's going to be April 7th through 9th. We're doing this for the first time as one event. Usually we do this as three separate events in the West Coast, East Coast, and Ireland. This year we've combined it all into one event. And the biggest news of all is not that we're going to have all these companies there. The biggest news is not that we're going to have the who's who sitting around the tables evaluating these startups. The biggest news is that Tom Salemi is going to join us.
Yes, that's right. I'm not a who's who, but I do matter.
You definitely matter, and you're definitely who's who. Yeah, no, we'll have, as I said, Radar Forum is April 7th through 9th. It's curated, it's invite only, but we're always looking for new people. So if you're a strategic, if you're somebody from one of the strategics and you're not already planning to be at Radar, or we haven't invited you, reach out to me afterwards. If you're an investor, a clinician, if you're somebody from one of the specialty societies, we'd love to have you there. We'll have 200 people who are going to be collaboratively evaluating companies. And I'm just going to repeat that again. It's collaborative diligence, which is very different than what you're used to. Usually, like, people have a one-on-one meeting with somebody and then, you know, they follow up or they don't. In this case, you're sitting around the table with the experts from the industry. So you've got an investor who's sitting there going, I hate this thing. I don't like the company. And then somebody's sitting there across the table who's the head of the value analysis committee for, you know, one of the top medical systems in the country. And they're going like, we would be using this tomorrow if it was available. So I don't know why you hate it. And vice versa. Somebody will say we love this and someone else will say we hate it, but it's a debate and it's collaborative in its feedback, and it's amazing. So that's the Radar Forum. It's coming up April 7th through 9th in Manhattan Beach, California, which is a nice warm place to be at this time of year.
It's great. It's in SoCal.
SoCal, right near the airport. We're like 15 minutes away from the airport.
Oh, fantastic. So
super convenient. It's a little like, it's actually a really nice kind of resort style hotel that has nine hole golf and pickleball. And we're going to have an In-N-Out truck. If anybody has never had In-N-Out, we're going to have an In-N-Out truck there to serve burgers while we play glow in the dark golf at night.
Did I
mention glow in the dark golf? So if the top,
I mean, so I would just go for that ball. I mean, that just sounds great.
I was going to say, if the top 150 startups on the planet and the top 200 people who are literally the decision makers of our industry isn't enough for you, glow in the dark golf might put you over the top.
We have a new associate editor around LA, Skylar Rivera. And I'm going to introduce you to her, Paul, because, I mean, that sounds like a really great event for her to check out.
Absolutely. Yeah. Love to have her there. That'd be great.
Fantastic.
In make that invite. And in fact, as I said, I'm inviting anybody who's listening to your podcast right now. If you're not a startup, if you're somebody who works with startups in some way, or you're a decision maker who might be investing in or acquiring a startup, reach out to me, paul@medtechinnovator.org, and I'll tell you how you might be able to be involved in Radar. And I say might because it's invite only. So I hate rejecting people, but it's invite only. Anyways, so that's Radar Forum. It's coming up.
Fantastic.
And it is absolutely one of the best experiences anybody has in the med tech industry. And I know that because people tell me that all the time. They say, you know, hey, it's fun to meet with startups, but boy, it's so cool to like listen to all these other people around the table tell you why they like or don't like these things interactively versus, you know, as I said, more of just kind of the one-on-one format. So it's something that's really unique to MedTech Innovator, and it's a really fantastic experience.
Great. Well, we're looking forward to that, we always enjoy the work you've done at Device Talks Boston. You will be there day one at Device Talks Boston this year, but you folks know how to put on a show. I've enjoyed them in Dublin and elsewhere, so looking forward to this experience. So thanks for having me out.
Yeah, super excited to have you be part of it. It's not something we've had the pleasure of before, so it's going to be great to have you there, Tom.
Well, that sounds like a great time, Paul, and looking forward to being out there. Chris Newmarker, though, we're here for you, my friend.
We're here for the Newmarkers newsmakers.
I'm saying it correctly. So let's roll into number five.
Let's get going. So number five on the list, we've got Ferroneuro raising $20 million, and they've named a former Medtronic executive as their CEO, Amasa Reitmeier, who has like more than two decades of medtech leadership experience. I mean, she most recently was VP of neuromodulation at Medtronic. So that's just fantastic. Ferro is based right here in Minneapolis, where I'm based, and their main technology is a cerebral spinal fluid management system. They also have Mind's Eye expandable port for cranial access and minimally invasive neurological procedures. So just some exciting news for this young company here in Minneapolis. Have you communicated with them before, Paul?
So Ferro has not been part of MedTech Innovator, but we've had other companies that are doing similar things like BrainSpace in MedTech Innovator. And, it's exciting because these companies are taking what was, you know, previously a more like, you know, a drain or something that, you know, doesn't sound very smart and interesting and turning it into like a data machine that can manage the way patients are cared for and interventions and monitoring things that normally you wouldn't be able to see in other modalities. So super exciting. And it's great to see somebody coming from Medtronic over to lead this company as a CEO, because, you know, I tell people all the time, every time you're pitching somebody in any meeting, I don't care if it's investor or strategic, it doesn't matter. What you should be trying to do is achieving two things. One, getting them to want to write you a check. That would be fantastic. And number two, if they can't do that, maybe they can quit their job and come work for you. And I'm like, every time our companies pitch, I say, like, if the person across the table doesn't say, huh, I wonder if I should quit my job and go work for this company, then you didn't do your best pitch. So clearly they must have done something right at Ferro.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And moving on to number four on the list. I mean, this is kind of a bit of a Medtronic heavy Newmarket newsmakers this week. But I mean, they're just been making a lot of news recently. Next up, we've got like Medtronic is pricing the IPO for their MiniMed diabetes unit. And so they're pricing it at up to $784 million. I mean, like we've been reporting a lot about, you know, the plans to separate out MiniMed, and it really just seems like an opportunity for Medtronic to like really better focus itself on, you know, some other technologies at the company. But man, I mean, so many MedTech IPOs recently. I mean, we were talking about the more IPOs in the newsmakers like a week ago. I'd be interested in having you on here, Paul. I mean, just because you're just following all these potential exits for young med tech companies. I mean, why are we all of a sudden? I mean, gosh, for years and years, I was hardly ever covered a med tech IPO, and now it seems like we're just seeing a lot of them. I mean, what's going on?
Yeah, well, I think like everything, it just takes a little bit of time, and then the public markets wake up to where there's value, and there's absolutely predictable value in the med tech sector. And, you know, for the startup innovation kind of ecosystem in general, there is nothing more important than IPOs. And not because they all will wind up exiting with an IPO, but because that really drives the flywheel that allows various layers of what they call the capital stack to invest in the med tech sector or any sector. And if you don't have IPOs, it makes it hard for people to get liquidity. And so, you know, the med tech sector has been almost entirely M&A in terms of exit for many, many years, as you said. And the lack of IPOs makes it hard for venture funds to raise capital. It makes it hard for the startups then to raise capital. And it just goes, you know, all the way downstream. So this is a big deal, not just that Medtronic is, you know, got MiniMed coming out as an IPO, but also just in general, it just means we're going to have more people, more retail investors and others who are out there looking at companies and going, oh, that's a med tech company. What are some other ones that we should be looking at and considering? And I can tell you, we got 800 or so in the MedTech Innovator portfolio alone that would love to have that opportunity. So, you know, it's a good fundraising opportunity, accessing the public markets and great validation for our space. So I'm really happy to see that. Great for diabetes in general to have, you know, a strong company out there on its own focused just on diabetes. There's so many diabetes innovations that are out there. We've had all these great companies in MedTech Innovator, companies like Nootromics, who just published some new exciting data. We've got great companies, but, you know, they need validation that, you know, this space matters. And nothing validates a space either like a big M&A deal or an IPO. So
yeah, it's kind of exciting too that you're going to have the, you know, the maybe perhaps before, you know, the opportunities to get acquired by, say, Medtronic's diabetes business was as much because it was part of this larger umbrella. But, you know, once they kind of get all the financing and whatever that comes from out of the way, that comes from getting spun out, you know, this independent company could maybe be more focused on acquiring some innovative technology. So, I mean, that's another potential buyer that's kind of getting a boost.
We have companies like BioLink and others. There's so many great ones out there. And they're just waiting, you know, they're just waiting for that time when they're either going to, you know, be a dominant player on their own, or they're going to merge with somebody else, or, you know, whatever that their outcome might be. But having capital markets that you can access quickly, you know, is something that's really different about the public market. You know, it's not just the IPO. There's future opportunities to quickly raise capital. Like literally overnight, companies can raise capital. And it might be expensive, but you can do, you know, shelf financings and all sorts of creative things where that you can do with a public market that you can't do in a private market that, you know, take much longer. So it's exciting. It's great news. The more med tech IPOs, the better.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So number three like on the list.
If you stack up the revenue too, I'm just looking at, looks like they make about $2.5 billion a year estimated, which puts them above Insulet, but below Dexcom, which is at $4 billion, and Abbott at $5 billion. So it's our immediately a big player. So, all right, Chris Neumarker.
All right, number three on the list, we've got Medtronic winning a CE mark for their next gen software model, like for GI Genius, Colon Pro software, and this is like AI assisted colonoscopy. Medtronic distributes the GI Genius with Cosmo Pharmaceuticals. They rolled this out in 2024, so just another boost for this platform, and you know it's been really referred to a lot over the years as being like a great example of that we're already seeing out there of AI being used in med tech in a very constructive way. You know, just the fact that, you know, like you can, that someone goes in for a colonoscopy and, you know, the doctor can actually see these little green boxes that say, hey, you might want to look at this like a little more closely. That's fantastic. So just just more advancing of this technology going on.
Yeah, you know, I think we've got about 80 companies in our portfolio in the GI space. And if you include colorectal, you know, then you've got another chunk more. It's amazing when you look at the difference that AI can bring to these procedures, it is astounding. And maybe we're seeing that with AI everywhere, but AI and endoscopy is a huge thing. So, you know, again, having this be an entire procedure that includes the AI is something that I think you're going to see everywhere. Procedural AI, operational infrastructure, and not like an add-on. That's really the key. So exciting stuff.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and we're going to move on here to number two. We're going to be talking about mechanical thrombectomy systems. In this case, this is like new guidelines from the American Heart Association and the American College of Cardiology, for pulmonary embolism. And, these are guidelines that are, that analysts say are a welcome change from existing qualifications, these updates are providing a boost to this type of technology. And like the really two players we're looking at right now are, Stryker after its acquisition of Inari Medical and Boston Scientific, which is, has a planned acquisition of Penumbra.
Yeah, I can tell you a little bit about, the PE space. We've got companies like Flow Medical, that are bringing really exciting new innovation to the space. The guidelines really matter. And I think that's the real, for me, the crux of this story is having guidelines, yeah, because it changes the game for everything. And this goes everything from on the procedural side up to reimbursement. These guidelines make a difference. And so having guidelines in place makes everything easier reduces friction for the industry. So thrilled to see that, investors like clarity, everybody likes clarity. So guidelines are a good thing. So I'm excited about that.
And Sean's article mentions that this is good news for imperative care, Incus Medical and Jupiter Endovascular, which are in the space as well. So,
yeah, but fantastic.
Guidelines are good. We all agree. Chris Neumarker, what's the big number one this week?
Hey, number one on the list. I mean, we've been reporting for a while that Johnson & Johnson was looking to separate out DePuy Synthes, which would be like the largest orthopedic device business in the world. But Sean Hooley, our senior editor over at Mass Device, caught a Bloomberg report, anonymous sources, but they're saying that they're actually eyeing to sell this to somebody. This could be a deal worth $20 billion potentially. So, I mean, of course, anonymous sources, these types of Bloomberg stories I've noticed don't always pan out, but definitely intriguing, and who might buy this business?
Yeah, no. Initially, I thought maybe given the revenue of about $9 billion or so, it seemed a bit low. But then as we sort of thought about it, and I put something out on LinkedIn with the level of the amount of annual growth and sort of just the state of orthopedics, it seems like a good ballpark for the price. And I imagine that we're going to see some private equity folks step in and do what private equity folks do. Paul, how do you see this playing out?
Yeah, no, I'm right there with you. The private equity folks, they really know their stuff. And, it's amazing because the difference between them and, the investors who invest early in these companies will often, look at something and go, oh, we want to get 3X or 4X or 5X or whatever they're looking for at a really early stage company. And a lot of times you look at those things and you go, oh, I can't see it being worth much more than that, let's say, wherever the company is. And then you have these PE guys who come in and look at something for that a $20 billion deal, and they still see the 5X or 10X potential on top of that. They really have to do their homework. So when again, these are all rumors that you're hearing right now, but
right.
But the reality is that this is a really important business. And and this is one of the biggest, and I think it's going to be a massive player in the future. I'm thrilled, by the way, as somebody who is there working with all these startups, I'm thrilled to have more acquirers. I want to see more things get divested versus consolidated. So I'm thrilled about this deal. I hope they get exactly what they deserve in pricing, which is a big number. So it's exciting stuff.
And it does like kind of play into this. I mean, if, as you said, rumors, I mean, who knows who it is, you know, but if it's private equity, it kind of goes along with this this trend that we've been seeing in recent years. I mean, covering this space for well over a dozen years, I mean, I've seen, you know, in that whole contract manufacturing supplier space, all kinds of private equity. But it really felt like it's only been like in the last few years that in the actual OEMs, that we've seen private equity, you know, moving into med tech, and really intriguing if this might be another big private equity play.
Yeah, they come and go. I think there's always waves like everything else. Private equity will get involved, and then it's too expensive. So then the IPO market. Well, it's going to be interesting to see how the surging IPO market impacts the valuation for private equity. It may actually cool things down for private equity if things get too hot and too expensive, and if I think if DePuy had their choice, they probably would do what Medtronic did with Minutemen and spin it out and put it on the public markets. I'm not sure if the growth is there for DePuy, but I'm intrigued by, I agree with Paul. I think having these sort of streamlined acquirers out there make the likelihood of acquisition or make acquisition more likely. And Paul, I suspect 2 or 3 years down the road, you'll be seeing some pitches from DePuy folks who have decided, you know what, now's the time I'd like to start growing my own company and follow my dreams and follow my own ideas. So I think we'll be seeing a shedding of a lot of great talent from DePuy that's going to really fuel the startup industry.
I sure hope so. There's nothing better than from people being able to take some money off the table and go back and join these earlier companies and really level up the leadership.
Absolutely.
I'm always excited about that opportunity. And, when you look at, again, you know, you look at leaders, you know, category leaders in a space, like it's important when, you know, they're focused and having, you know, a player that's, you know, totally focused, on the orthopedic space, like that's a big deal. So, we like that. It helps everybody. So again, I'm excited about this. And I hope I hope they get the value that they deserve for sure.
Absolutely. All right, Chris Neumacher. Well, this is a great top five, but, folks love five of the biggest news items of the day. How can they get that sent to their inboxes?
Oh my gosh, just go to Mass Device, sign up for our daily plus five newsletters. You'll get the top five news every day, though. Still, come on here and listen to me and Tom and sometimes even Paul here come and talk about the news.
It's always great to have a who's who on the newsmaker, for sure. And Paul, you invite folks to reach out to you about the Radar Forum. Give us the dates again, and what's the best way for folks to connect, just on LinkedIn?
Yeah, so anybody who wants to find me, the easiest place is medtechinnovator.org. So if you just go to our website, www or no www, either one, it works just fine. Medtechinnovator.org. You can learn about us. There's a link right at the top about the Radar Forum. So you can click that to learn more. You can email me, paul@medtechinnovator.org. And yes, my favorite place is probably to hang out on LinkedIn, because that means people can connect with me directly and quickly, and I don't have to read through 700 email messages to find it. So LinkedIn is just fine. It's easy to find me there. Just look for Paul Grand on LinkedIn and you should find me pretty quickly at MedTech Innovator. And again, Radar Forum is April 7th through 9th. It's in Manhattan Beach, California. As I said, very close to the airport. We'll tell you the secret hotel if you get invited to join us, then we'll tell you where to go. We don't want to have just a ton of people just hanging out at the hotel. So we'll let you know the location afterwards. But it's very exciting. As I said, there'll be about 400 or so people, 350 to 400 people in total between the innovators and the who's who of the industry who'll be there collaboratively evaluating these companies. And as I said, even if you're not an investor, even if you're not, somebody at a strategic, if you're somebody who has expertise, you really feel like you're part of that who's who, you know more than others about your particular discipline, whatever it is, could be regulatory, could be reimbursement, could be product development, whatever it might be. If you feel you have some value to add, reach out to me. We always want to add people to our ecosystem. We have literally thousands of people in the ecosystem, and we're always looking for new people. So reach out to me. We'd love to have you at Radar Forum or just to connect with you in general.
All right. Sounds great. Sounds like a great time. Paul Grand, thanks for joining us on the Newsmakers.
Thank you, guys. Great being here.
Fun as always. Hope your voice gets better.
Hey, me too. It can only get better.
Right. It can only get better from here.
It can only get better from here. Yeah. No, thank you, guys. It's great being here. I love being in the booth with you guys.
All right. Thanks, Chris Newmarker and Paul Grand, for this week's Newmarker's Newsmakers. Look forward to seeing folks at MedTech Innovators Radar Forum in April. Please go to medtechinnovator.org for more information. Now, of course, our keynote conversation is with Kelsey Mayo of Armor Medical. So just to set the scene, Armor Medical is one of four or five startups, MedTech Innovator finalists, that presented at AdvaMed back in October at their meeting in San Diego. They all presented on stage, and the winner was chosen by the folks in the audience. I was there as well. And Armor Medical walked away with the grand prize of $350,000 to advance their maternal armor, which is a non-invasive real-time monitoring system to detect early hemorrhaging. It's really a clever, clever way of potentially saving a lot of lives. So I really enjoyed this conversation with Kelsey Mayo. We talked a lot about entrepreneurship, about risk, and of course, about the importance of medtech. Let's listen. Well, Kelsey Mayo, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much, Tom. It's good to be here.
I'm excited to finally have you on. I tried to approach you after you won the MedTech Innovator Award at AdvaMed. You were at the cocktail party that night, but you had a line of people and you had a massive check with you that you were still carrying, which I thought was hysterical and just a huge flag and a great icebreaker at a cocktail party. So
that was so much fun. Yes. honestly, carrying around the big check was a highlight. And later my co-founder and I took it, because this was in San Diego, and so we took it on a mini bike tour all around all the tourist hotspots, and so it was a blast.
I did check that. Folks should go on your LinkedIn page. There's a video of it you posted a few months ago about that. So yeah, I'm glad you had a lot of fun with the massive check. Where is the massive check reside now?
It's at my office. So right now I'm recording from my home office, but we have space right behind Georgia Tech and Science Square. And so it's proudly displayed there at my office.
That's fantastic. All right. So how did we get to where we are? How did you find your way into the medtech industry?
Ooh, excellent question. So it's funny because I started my career as a material scientist, materials engineering, and really have focused in precision medicine for the entire time that I've been fascinated by materials. Because frankly, something struck me. If you're going to put in a lot of really hard work after hours, especially at this time I was working in the research lab, I wanted it to have a human impact, a tangible human impact. So I kept getting closer and closer to the medical world. And when I was getting my doctorate at Vanderbilt, I was building nanoparticle drug delivery systems.
Very cool.
Thank you. I think so too. So, you know, it is kind of fascinating to think, how did somebody who's a material scientist who got a doctorate developing nanoparticle drug delivery systems develop a med tech wearables company in women's health? And, you know, looking back on it, it said like that, it seems strange, but it was very intuitive to me because I kept trying to build my career where I felt that my passion met the world's needs. And so there was this really stark moment when I was in grad school and I had my hands, it was way late at night. I was, you know, after a marathon of lab work, had my hands in the fume hood. And I realized what I was building while I was going to get the big paper, the publication track record, you know, thumbs up, looking good. Nothing that I did felt scalable. I couldn't imagine somebody manufacturing these things. And I asked myself why, you know, why at the end of the day am I doing this? And I started it to help people. And I really wanted to build medicines that made a difference, had a human impact. And so I call this moment, and folks might have heard me say this before, but it was like I was hand building a supercar and the world just needed a Camry. And that was striking to me. And it was really a pivotal moment when I started shifting more towards entrepreneurship.
So did you have any kind of family connection to healthcare, or any parent who was in healthcare, or where do you think that need to have an impact comes from?
That's a good question. Actually, I come from a fairly blue-collar background. My mom, she was a zoologist by training and then a stay-at-home mom. And then later she had to reinvent herself and was in education IT.
Okay.
My dad, he's really the canonical entrepreneur. He was a nuclear pharmacist when I was a kid, built a business in the 80s doing nuclear pharmacy, and he sold his business, and the sale of his business got him hooked on the transaction. So he went into commercial real estate. And as a kid, I actually, it was fascinating to watch both of my parents navigate their journeys because they both had to reinvent themselves. It was feast or famine. You know, we were either fairly wealthy or very not wealthy. And by the time I was going through school, we were in the very not wealthy. And so I was kind of scrapping for everything. I had to put myself through school. I was the crazy kid as an undergrad. I went to all my professors at Georgia Tech and I said, I'd love to work in your research lab because I want to build my resume. I think I want to do this science thing for real, but I have to get paid for it. And the shock on their faces, what? Freshman, yeah. Undergrad, you want to get paid? And I was like, yeah, I've got to buy groceries. So, you know, I'll go bag groceries at the grocery store if I have to, but I'd much prefer to do something resume building. And I had one guy take a chance on me, and it was Dr. Larry Bottomley. And he was the first and only person willing to give me a paycheck to do work. And he was also one of the biggest mentors that it just happened. His lab did biosensors and nanotechnology and biosensors. And it was, again, I realized I love this stuff. I love the fact that what I'm building can be used to improve people's health.
That's amazing. And I mean, it seems as if both your parents were driven by a passion. So it was probably imprinted upon you early on to do what you love, to marry your passion with your career. Is that accurate, or am I podcast reaching with that?
No, it's accurate. The irony is, after growing up in the feast or famine, I thought, man, I need stability.
Yeah.
So the fact that I took the leap of faith to start a company and the ultimate stretch of uncertainty, I really owe that, frankly, to my husband. So I've been together with my husband, Trent, for 18 years. And he also comes, his mom was an entrepreneur, a business owner, a crisis counselor, actually. And so he kind of grew up in this environment. But unlike me, he loves risk taking. He's actually a stunt driver as well.
Oh, no kidding.
And so that like is his bread and butter. And so I've always had I really genuinely motivated by helping people. I think you should leave the world a better place than when you came into it. But again, I had the battle, my own. I don't really want to, you know, I was risk averse, kind of ironically. And this is kind of jumping into the real fire in your belly kind of moment. But when Trent and I had our first son, he was 18 months old. Trent was doing stunt driving in Atlanta. I was living in Nashville. And I was sitting in my office and nearly died of a hemorrhage.
Oh, my God.
And I say that this is a jump in the story, but it's really meaningful to me, because you were talking about like why take risk. And I would say it started somewhat academically and because of what I would maybe consider my nature, but I knew that hemorrhage was a problem for moms. I knew that this was a solvable problem, a preventable cause of massive amounts of mortality and morbidity. And I'd even talked with my now co-founder about, hey, can we use this really cool tech to solve this? I think we can. Mm-hmm. But then at that point, you know, where I'm sitting in my office, I don't know what's wrong with me, enormous amounts of pain in my abdomen, whited out from pain, and was wheeled into the ER by a coworker where I was dismissed. I was ignored. I was told it was in my head. It was gas. It wasn't. I had had an ovarian cyst rupture and twisted a fallopian tube, and I had been bleeding internally for 10 hours. And the only reason I was taken seriously and my pain was taken seriously is because I was about to pass out on the floor of the emergency department waiting room. And one of the nurses looked at me and she was arguing with me, telling me I couldn't lay down. This was not where I wanted to sleep. And I said, ma'am, I can't help it. And then a LifeLight medic saw me and realized I was going into hemorrhagic shock.
Holy.
And so I get wheeled back, and he was the first person. And this is a shout out to those folks who are truly heroes in healthcare. He looked at me and said, you're not faking it. This is real. And we're going to take care of you. And sorry, I still get choked up.
No, and full disclosure, I read the article you wrote for the Atlanta Business Chronicle, I think it is. And so I came into this interview knowing that you had had an experience with hemorrhaging. I didn't realize it hit you in your office. And oh my gosh, is not at all fake, because I can't believe you're in the ER, you're bleeding internally, and they're trying to send you home. I mean,
yeah.
That's just so discouraging.
You know, and I was a PhD in biomedical field, working for a big healthcare system, and I was being gaslit and I had no advocate. And by that point I had lost so much blood, I couldn't think straight.
Of course. Yeah.
And my husband was working in Atlanta. He drove like a bat out of hell, frankly, to get up once he heard that I was in the hospital, made it. I had an emergency surgery, blood transfusion, and survived. And that is the moment, waking up from that experience, knowing that I had almost lost my life. And the scary thing about that was thinking I would never see my family again. And I knew it was not long after that moment, I just looked at Trent and I was like, well, if this isn't the universe telling you that we need to do something, this is a problem we've talked academically about solving. And here's your wake up call that like we need to be doing something. That was it. And from that point on, it's almost been a no-brainer, you know, if we really have an opportunity to keep any other families from going through this type of experience, how can we not?
Absolutely. That's, and to go into obstetrics and delivery, I mean, that's a setting where I think, unfortunately, a lot of this goes on as well, the gaslighting, the lack of information, lack of communication, you're in there helpless. And as try as you hard as a soon to be parent to be informed, you just don't know what you don't know, and you don't know when to advocate and when to push. So I think it's remarkable to and we'll get into your technology in a moment, but for some reason I did want to come to this conversation unpacking the sort of entrepreneur trip, and I'm glad you kind of hit upon it early. Do you think this life and death experience kind of reset risk in your mind? Because, you know, I think we all have this temptation of starting a company and we all worry about risk, but risk is everywhere. Risk is at a big job. Risk is walking down the stairs. Risk is everything and everywhere. How do you see risk now? Did it readjust things?
Completely. 100%. And for a while, I mean, it still took a little bit of time for my co-founders to invent the device, patent it. They're faculty over at WashU. We kept in contact through this entire period, but it was fascinating that you really get a sense of the veil is removed.
Mm-hmm.
Risk is everywhere. And wouldn't you rather spend the most precious resource that you have, your time, on something that you care deeply about? And that was it for me. And it's still been a journey. You know, I started taking those steps. And then, mm-hmm. as is probably the path of many entrepreneurs, you know, I took the leap of faith. I quit my day job. We started the company June 2022. I quit my day job in October because it's very difficult to be the mom of two small kids and basically mm-hmm. working two jobs. And I knew I didn't want to give half of my heart to this company. I knew that Armor Medical was something that deserved my all. And so I took the leap of faith, and there were definitely periods where we had, you know, I couldn't pay myself because everything had to go into the company. And you have to be willing to just say, I believe it will be okay. Like, there's mm-hmm. always a way to problem solve in the moment. No matter what hits you, you can figure out how to, we call it pivot over, I mean, it's kind of overused, but you can figure out how to move, right? Move mm-hmm. with it, move around it, over it. Lord, like invent a teleport and go through it. It's risk is just problem solving, right? You just, how do you characterize it? And then with the information you have at hand, how do you move it forward? And it's actually, when you start to shift your mindset, it becomes fun.
Yeah.
I love problem solving. And if the problem is hard and if it's interesting and if it's a rewarding solution, then heck yeah, sign me up.
I love that. And I love that the vision that vision of the field. I feel like having done what I've done for as long as I've done it, I now feel comfortable whenever I need to make a decision. Let's just do that. Like, we'll do that. We'll figure it out. We'll get there. Like, whereas 10 years ago, 20 years ago, I would have fretted about this way or that. Now I see the field more clearly, and I may not know the direct path there, but I feel like I can, to your point, get us there and problem solve. So it's wonderful to have that confidence in view. I'm curious, if you don't mind me asking, Trent's had a vision of risk early on. I mean, for his job, and there's an entrepreneurial background as well. Do you find your visions are aligned now, or is he like, whoa, you're like, you've like shot past me in terms of
no risk? He'll probably laugh when he hears that. No, he to this day, I'm still a little bit less of the risk taker than he is, but
okay, well, that's probably,
you know,
healthy.
He's just, you know, and that's something that I will say is I'm able to do what I'm able to do because I have an amazing support system. I have mm-hmm. people around me professionally and personally who are 100%, they believe in what we're doing. They know me as a person. And so I have that support, and I am very grateful. I'm also surrounded by people who are brilliant in so many different areas, and Trent being one of them too. You know, I joke with him. He's the best unpaid intern that Armor has ever had. And I, you know, when you talk to other entrepreneurs, especially early stage companies, a lot of us have somebody mm-hmm. who's the unsung hero who really, without them, it couldn't have happened. And so, you know, an organization is its people, and sometimes those people are both paid by the company, and sometimes they're the people in your personal life that allow you to be a human that can do these things.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing. Well, I could spend the entire time talking about this, but let's focus a bit on Armor, because it's a great story as well. So how did you mentioned your horrible experience, the inspiration you had, or the clarity you got from that. And then you began talking with your co-founders. Walk us through a bit through the co-founding of the company and the origin of the technology that you're using.
Yeah. So this technology is really the brainchild of my colleague and dear friend, Dr. Christine O'Brien. Mm-hmm. She and I met at Vanderbilt in graduate school, and her specialty is biomedical optics. And so she has spent her career building optical devices, and she really applies the lens of global health and women's health. So she is absolutely brilliant. And one of the things that sets her apart as an engineer is she doesn't overcomplicate things, and she's not forever iterating just to make it an nth degree better. She actually starts with the problem first, and she, what is the problem that we are trying to solve? And then she looks at the toolkit available to her and figures out not only what would be excellent at solving the problem, but there's this practical and applied lens that is rare, and I think often undervalued, especially in an academic setting. And that is this a fairly inexpensive problem? If you're talking about a global health solution, can this be manufactured at scale inexpensively? Is it, you know, something which has to be housed in a special insulated warehouse, or is it something that can withstand the real world? Mm-hmm. And she started from her side, you know, I think if you asked her, she would probably say it was the global health lens that really started her thinking about hemorrhage. She took global health classes at Vanderbilt and was shocked to learn about, you know, the leading causes of maternal mortality. And when she first told me, this was over a decade ago, that we know we can prevent all of these poor outcomes if we just catch it early, but the tools clinicians have today are primarily visual blood loss estimation mm-hmm. or weighing blood-soaked pads. That moment was sobering. Because we kept thinking, why? Why has nobody looked at this problem and started to build a better tool? There's got to mm-hmm. be a better way to measure blood loss. So she started thinking about, well, what makes it hard? Why hasn't it been solved? And here's the fascinating thing about a maternal hemorrhage specifically. We know that when we're pregnant, we build up about 50% more blood volume than a non-pregnant person. Huh. And so when you have any sort of acute hemorrhage, even if you're not pregnant, the first thing the body does is this autonomic response. We clamp down on blood vessels in our periphery to shunt blood away from areas of the body we really don't need it in an emergency to your core to protect all of your vital organs. Mm-hmm. That is called a compensation response. And now imagine that you're when you're pregnant, you now have so much extra blood supply in your periphery that you have this extraordinary ability to compensate for blood loss. So if you go talk to an OB-GYN, what they will tell you is when you see a pregnant patient that is suffering from a maternal hemorrhage, she's otherwise typically young, healthy. She looks fine. She looks fine. She looks fine. And then she goes off a cliff and she's not fine. And that's because she's really good at compensating for blood loss. So if you're just relying on traditional vitals like heart rate and blood pressure, you're essentially missing this silent early stages of bleeding. And only when that person, in the case of a pregnant patient, has lost like 25% of their total blood volume. So we're talking like a liter and a half of blood.
Wow.
Only then do you often see this hemorrhagic shock, you know, and now we are in an emergency. And so that is kind of the crux of one of the reasons this is so hard to see. And it's not like in these patients, you're doing invasive monitoring. It's not like we're putting in an A-line to understand how their hemodynamics are shifting. That's just not done. We don't do invasive monitoring on pregnant patients. So this is where she started. And she said, well, if the earliest response to blood loss is this compensation, is this peripheral vasoconstriction, what if we look at that? Is there a way to really, really accurately measure these subtle changes in peripheral blood perfusion and from that determine hemorrhage risk in real time and hopefully catch this earlier? So that was really, that was her idea. That was where she started with. And then she went on to think about the toolbox, you know, of all the possible technologies that could be used to measure this, what fits the bill? And she landed on a technology called laser speckle imaging. Laser speckle imaging is like a sister technology, if you will, to pulse oximetry.
Okay.
And so what it actually does is it measures the velocity of flowing red blood cells. And it does this non-invasively. It does this with a laser and a camera. But it had never been made wearable before. You know, nothing had been done to make this into something that could truly be a wearable tech that would fit the bill for where this technology would need to live in the real world. But it did have a lot of advantages that made it attractive. Things like it was very, very sensitive. So much higher signal-to-noise ratio, which hugely important when compared with pulse ox is specifically what I'm talking about. Hugely important if you're trying to measure flow in the setting of hemorrhage, where blood flow might already be pretty low to begin with. It also has some benefits when it comes to motion artifact. So higher resistance to motion artifact. Again, good.
What is motion artifact? What is motion?
So when you're in the real world, you're moving around, a lot of technologies will interfere with the ability for that device to get good signal.
Need to get recalibrated and kind of reset and kind of.
You got it. And so we spend a lot of time in the wearables industry making sure that the device works, even if you're moving around. So, you know, just mentally picture, right? Setting of a woman in labor. In some cases, you know, she might be bouncing on a ball, right? So we know that there's movement involved here. We have to be able to be effective in these settings. And then finally, and this is where my second co-founder here, Leo, comes in. Dr. Leo Smoilovich is a brilliant dermatologist. He's an MD, PhD, also works at WashU. And he and Christine met when they were in their postdoctoral positions. Because Christine was thinking through this technology, and another thing that she needed to make sure of was that the device worked robustly across all skin tones. So if you remember, you know, in light-based tools like the pulse ox, historically, I don't think device manufacturers have paid enough attention to how robustly devices work for all people who are going to need to wear it. And so my hats really go off to my co-founders in this, because Leo is this is his specialty, like his bread and butter. He's actually kind of like a MacGyver. I adore working with Leo. he's the kind of person that would have like a bay of 3D printers on his kitchen table. I mean, he's fabulous. But he also comes with this brilliance of how to make light-based devices work well across all skin tones. And so when Leo and Christine, together with a brilliant student in Christine's lab, created this technology and really envisioned it, all of those things were baked in from the get-go, which is fabulous. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, she started from the physiology, kind of locked in on this could work, but there were a number of things that have to be done to the tech to actually make it work in the real world. And then she pulled a team of expertise around her, to create it. And so that was the origin story of the technology itself and the original patent on the device.
So when did Armor Medical come into being, and when did all that you just described become a company?
Yes. Okay. So they built this thing and they put it on a swine in a controlled model of hemorrhage to see, does this actually work? Mm-hmm. So this was a swine model. And we knew exactly how much blood the swine was losing. And they did a resuscitation. So they put IV fluids basically back. And I got a call. I was at work and I got a call from Christine, and she was beyond excited. And she said, I have to show you this data. So I think we got on Zoom and she showed me the data, and I was floored, because this is basically the raw signal we're looking at. And the correlation between the change in fluids that her, you know, first version of the prototype that she ever built And what we knew was being lost, like the hemorrhage event itself, was 0.98.
Wow.
And I paused. And we looked at each other, because if you know science and engineering, nothing ever works the first time around. And certainly you don't see it in that raw signal. And I just remember telling Christine, I said, you've got something. You absolutely have something here. And she said, I think I do. And then she followed up with, and in 2 weeks, 3 weeks, somewhere like that, there is this big, I think it was NIH, it was the National Technology Accelerator Challenge, NTAC, I believe is the acronym. And it was this big wearables for maternal health challenge. She said, hey, we know the tech works, but we have to do some work to think about how this could actually be a product. And I know that that's your specialty, Kelsey. So could you help me think through, like, for this application, how we take the tech and actually make it a thing? And that technology was a little bit more, again, for like global health settings. That was kind of the lens for that application. So sure enough, I said, absolutely, happy to help, you know, put it together. We, in the span of a couple weeks, threw this thing in, and we got honorary mention out of every single entry in the entire country, which was, whoa, to me, a huge signal, right? You know, yes, we didn't take top prize, but daggum, with a couple of weeks of work, we were like right up there. There is something here. This is real signal. And so the natural next step was, well, do you want to apply for an SBIR? And I said, yeah, let's do it. And so because we knew we were going in for an SBIR, we formed the company. That was June 2023, I think. Mm-hmm. I might be getting my dates mixed up. It kind of blurs, but that was essentially the impetus, right? I came into the company. We founded the company because she had such promising data from the first thing she built, and the potential just kept growing, you know. And then it was more about, for SBIR world, you have to do the customer discovery. Is there a market for this thing? Can this really become a product? Is there a real world need? And what blew me away during that period was the appetite and the interest from the boots on the ground, the clinicians, the nurses, the OBs, the OB anesthesiologist, were the people who kept looking at what we're doing and going, this is game changing. And that was, again, that was just that we kept hearing good signal. Yeah, it was going to be hard. Yeah, there was a long way to go, but like, this could really work.
That's amazing. So at the time, just before you were at Vanderbilt University of Medical Center, were you involved with sort of company creation or spinning out IP? I was looking at your job at the time. Was that what you were doing at Vanderbilt?
No, I.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I almost went to work with their tech transfer office. There's a good group of folks there, but I was instead recruited to build the data and research center for the next phase of the Human Genome Project. It's a big research program called the All of Us Research Program. And the reason I loved it was because it was sort of fitting this fascinating need within precision medicine, because I knew, again, precision medicine was kind of my background, my career. And if you really want to provide proactive treatment that was tailored to meet the person, then we need better data to do all the science that even makes that possible. So the All of Us research program had this really ambitious goal of recruiting 1 million or more people from across the United States to contribute their health information. And it was more than I'd ever seen done before. It was electronic health records, wearables data, survey data, genomics, other types of omics. And all of this information would be pulled, harmonized, de-identified, and made into a resource to drive forward precision medicine research on a scale that we'd never seen before. Cool. And so I had been involved in a bunch of entrepreneurial activities. I knew kind of a group of folks that were in this space. And I was, I think, hire number 6 for the team that was doing this at Vanderbilt. And I remember when I was brought on, I was told I was going to be doing one thing, but I had to build everything first. Like, at some point, you're going to be able to do this. But before we do that, here is, you know, go sit in this meeting. And I sketched out on a sheet of paper what essentially was the entire data ecosystem for this massive project. And then I had the amazing opportunity to go build it. And so the thing that I had in that setting, which I didn't have now and as a new founder, is I had money to run with from the very beginning. So we actually were starting from like a $75 million grant. And we had the world-class collaborators. I mean, we got to work with people at Columbia University in New York on electronic health record harmonization and utilization. And these guys are brilliant. We got to work with the team essentially from Alphabet and Google, all the Google engineers on our back end, which spoiled me for life. So if David Glazer listens to this podcast, his team and his engineers are brilliant. And then at Vanderbilt, we had bioinformaticists. So people who just are to this day still on the cutting edge of how do you leverage all this brilliant data and do it in a way that protects privacy? And then also in this amazing crucible of creation here was this lens of build it with the community. So I loved that the All of Us program had this idea of participants in the study are partners. They are not research subjects. They are participants. And to build this program correctly, you have to do authentic engagement with these communities to engage people that have never had their voice represented in this type of data set. You have to be smart and you have to be community engaged. And so all of those pieces, you know, allowed me to not only essentially get a real world MBA and build up this massive organization and launch products and keep the lights on and all that, but I was also exposed to concepts that are incredibly valuable for the data-driven day and age that we are in today for medtech.
That's amazing. So this is interesting because you weren't exactly selling paper or copiers when you decided to pursue your dream of starting a company. You had a pretty sweet gig that just hearing you describe it, it still gets you excited. What was the, you got the news, you got the data, you were decided to go forward with the SBIR. At what point were you all in? And you're like, to your earlier point, you didn't want to love two things. Like, what point did you say I'm all in Armor Medical and I'm going to start a company? And what was that process like?
So it started with pain because that summer. So gosh, I'm trying to think of what summer this was, but the summer after we formed the company, we were going in for the SBIR. My days looked like this. It was wake up before anybody in my house got up. So, you know, 4 or 5 a.m., work for a couple of hours on this grant and on Armor as a company, get the kids up, get them ready to school, get them off to school, then work my day job all day, and then finish my day job at Vanderbilt. I was working remotely at the time, so that did help with things. And then, you know, get the kids from school, make dinner, do all the things, and then put the kids to bed and then go to work again. And so I was getting very little sleep. And I was doing too much all at once, and it was unsustainable, and I knew it. But what I mentioned earlier about the customer discovery being so critical to knowing that this is real signal, I mean, that was it. Everything I have, so this is interesting, and I think it's been part of our success as a company. We earnestly are going to solve this problem. And to do that, I think you have to leave your ego on the table a little bit and be willing to throw your ideas out in the world to people who are going to challenge them and be willing for them to take their red pen out and mark all over your ideas and give it back to you, bleeding essentially on a sheet of paper, and go, okay, and we can make it better. And what was fascinating is, of course, we had these experiences where people were like, yeah, this isn't going to work, or this isn't going to work, but this is an excellent idea. And what if? And, you know, that sort of, it, even in spite of all of the obstacles that we even put in front of it to see, like, is it going to hold up? Is this actually going to hold water? It did. And so we knew we had something, but the reality of I had no work-life balance, and trying to get work-life balance was costing me my sleep because I couldn't do all of it. I just, I talked to my husband. I talked to Trent and said, what if? And should I? And he said, absolutely. And if you look at where you're at today and you don't do it, will you always regret it? And I knew mm-hmm. the answer was yes. And yep. so that was it. You know, just that's, like, okay, let's rip the Band-Aid off and go for it.
That's always the best measure for me. If you imagine yourself looking back and saying, am I going to regret it? And if the answer is yes, then
they go for it.
Then you're going to go for it. So looking at your website, armormedical.us, I love the layout, by the way. I love the problem tab and then the solution tab, like just very clear. I'm a very problem solution guy. So this is wonderful. Looking at, it looks like you've got an Apple Watch, a smartwatch that someone would wear. Talk a bit about where you are with the product development.
Yeah.
And then we can sort of unpack how you see this playing out once you go commercial, which I think you're hoping to do next year, right? 2027?
Yeah, so we're essentially hoping to get our FDA authorization next year. And so really mm-hmm. looking at commercial early 2028. And this technology, we essentially came up with a product that is a wrist-worn Apple Watch-like device that is connected with a patient monitoring app. And so the first product in our pipeline is intended to be used in this inpatient setting where we know this is the highest risk window for maternal hemorrhage. And I am intentionally focusing for this conversation on the obstetric hemorrhage application. Mm-hmm. We know we've done some work really showing the extensibility of this technology to other cardiovascular monitoring needs, hemorrhage in other areas and other populations. But again, just for right now, I want to focus on obstetrics because that is where we're launching. That's the first application. And the first 24 hours after you deliver your baby is where you're at highest risk. And in the United States, 98% of women are delivering in a hospital setting. So we knew that this, again, first intended use is in this hospital setting. We've got the device that's monitoring blood flow, essentially, and then sharing insights with your provider through this patient monitoring app. And essentially, that's trying to mimic the way that providers are already getting a lot of other patient vitals. Mm-hmm. So you can imagine the way that today we see heart rate, blood pressure, SpO2, all on sort of these inpatient monitoring units. We are following that same sort of workflow with what we're doing in our first device. And now remind me. So I just wanted to kind of set the stage with
sure.
This is what it is. And then what was the second part of your question?
The second, well, let's talk a bit about so commercially, you're not commercial, what sort of testing are you, and I did not ask this before, what kind of testing are you undergoing right now? You're looking for FDA notification next year. What is that? How do you get there? What will happen between now and then?
Yeah, so we have already done both animal and human studies at WashU. So this was mm-hmm. funded by NIH grants and CDC grants to both my co-founders as faculty and to Armor through the SBIR program. And we have shown in these studies the feasibility of doing real-time blood loss measurement in milliliters, you know, predicting blood loss in milliliters in real time. Also getting other hemodynamic parameters that inform hemorrhage risk in real time. And so we've done those feasibility studies already. That is the basis for our work in preparation for commercial launch, both regulatory and also getting adopted by what is historically a more conservative community of clinicians within obstetrics mm-hmm. and gynecology. So the work that we're doing is essentially, it's actually pretty complicated because the standard of care in L&D for doing real-time blood loss measurements doesn't exist. We also, because we're doing essentially weighing blood-soaked pads, they're in the C-section, they're suctioning out blood with a vacutainer and looking at it. So these are very discontinuous measures, and they're very hard to do accurately. So basically, imagine us as this medtech startup going, you know, we want to basically vet and validate that our technology does what we say it does in this population. We want to show the accuracy of our blood loss prediction. We want to show the accuracy of our hemodynamic parameter prediction. And yet the population that we're trying to do this in, there is no good gold standard. Again, like in a healthy mom, you're not going to be doing invasive A-lines to get accurate systemic vascular resistance. You're just not, they don't do that unless you're really, really high risk. And we are talking about using our device on every single patient, whether or not you're deemed high risk, because we know 40% of people that weren't known as high risk end up having a hemorrhage. So we have to be measuring them. So that being said, our team has spent a lot of time thinking about the work to gather evidence that really supports both our regulatory plan as well as being adopted into the field of obstetrics by these clinicians who are understandably a little bit risk averse and a little bit more conservative. And so step one is we had to come up with studies that allow us to go head to head with really accurate gold standards, even if it wasn't in the setting of L&D. So we've developed, and again, my hat's off to Christine. She was the one that came up with this, a blood donor model that really allows us to go and say, if we go to the most accurate blood loss measurement we can think of, which is actually weighing in real time the exact amount of blood that's being donated, and compare how well our device is predicting that blood loss based off of our signal, like that is how we really understand the accuracy. So we've already done like I think about 13 patients. So she's, I say we, but I want to be clear. Like this is work that Christine is leading.
Sure.
And I think company, it's fine. The next year is really about the company taking the clinical grade unit, so the commercial grade device, and replicating that work, right? And so showing with our system that, again, we can accurately measure blood loss, which we've done in our prior studies. The second piece is this other hemodynamic parameters. So I mentioned systemic vascular resistance. That's a key one for us. So we also designed another study to go head-to-head with another gold standard reference, which is really, you can't do it while you're in L&D, because there's really, again, no way to do this right now in L&D. So that's the other piece. And then once those two are locked in, we'll be going into L&D and saying, yep, okay, we've validated that we can do accurate blood loss prediction in real time, and we can accurately get these other hemodynamic parameters. Then the next challenge is going in and saying, and in the setting of L&D, here's how we compare to the existing standard of care. And so if you look at when our device sees early signs of hemorrhage, how does that compare with the current standard of care? How much earlier, essentially? Because we believe we can detect it at least 5 times earlier than the standard of care, which is hugely meaningful from a clinical perspective.
Sure.
But then we've just got to do that in more patients to really get that nice body of evidence to support commercialization.
So are you hearing from strategics? I mean, I think of Stryker buying a company that uses AI to measure the blood loss by looking at the pads that are absorbing the blood. I mean, there's already a recognition that this is something that needs to be addressed and something needs to be monitored. And you're getting at it a lot earlier than that does, because you can track it before the blood exits the body. I imagine you're getting some attention from larger companies. I mean, this, you're right. Every person who has an operation really could make an argument for them wearing one of these just as a safety check.
That's spot on. You know, it was to your point, I most often get outreach immediately from anybody in critical care, but also like people who see traumatic hemorrhage in settings outside of obstetrics. We see a lot of interest from anesthesia. So this is from the clinician perspective, then I'll get to strategics. So anesthesiologists are really excited because we're essentially directly measuring peripheral perfusion. And at its core, anesthesia is perfusion and compensation. And right now they use blood pressure as a proxy oftentimes, which is a delayed indicator. So got a lot of excitement from that community. And then post-surgical monitoring, my neighbor next door, he had a hemorrhage scare after a colonoscopy where he'd had a polyp resected. And in the middle of the night, he's home post-surgery. And of course, he didn't realize he was bleeding internally until it was an emergency. And thank God they got him to the hospital and he's okay now. But, wow. You know, I look at that and that's another thing. It's like, gosh, if we could send our device home with anybody, yeah. right? Yeah. And we could pick up on these signals. It's this moment of right now we're guessing, but in the future, we'll know because we'll have the data to drive that decision proactively. So we're not going to wait until it's, you know, a near miss.
Right.
So.
Wow.
Yeah. That's the sort of moment where, yes, we see it. We see the potential here in these other places. Accordingly, we are absolutely getting interest from strategics and they fall into a couple of different categories. I'll say one category is somebody who may already be in this space, this obstetric space, and they perhaps even have devices that are useful in the treatment of early stage hemorrhage, but it's really hard to detect early stage hemorrhage. And so because our device allows you to do that, we essentially help them deploy more of their product at early stages and improve patient outcomes as a result. So there's that group of folks who we've been talking with for a while. And that's really, you know, when we think about our job as a startup, we have to do what we say we're going to do, right? And demonstrate a utility in that particular application. I would say more recently, especially as some of our newer research is ongoing, as we'll be publishing more results that kind of show the breadth of things that we can look at, we're seeing folks in the advanced patient monitoring space become interested. Mm-hmm. And again, we're essentially the first wearable laser speckle technology. There's a lot of advantages over pulse ox. We're able to measure different hemodynamic parameters than right now most patient monitoring suites can do. So we're starting some of those conversations, met with some really awesome teams, frankly, that are interested in where this is going. So that's kind of the second piece, the second class of strategics, I would say. And then you do have kind of the third piece here, which is right now, my Garmin, my Apple Watch can't do what we do. You have to have different hardware than is typically baked into these devices. But as is the way with all hardware and electronics, right, things are getting smaller. Things are getting faster. So it's very realistic to say in the next couple of years, you can take what we do and put it in more consumer-like technologies as well. And in doing so, once again, you're opening up a new, really rich data stream that is very information-rich when it comes to very clinically useful information. And so that's like a third group there that I'd highlight.
That's remarkable. I mean, just as you're talking, I'm thinking of people on blood thinners. I'm thinking of there's something really, I see this as, and it is a version of stroke. It's something very primal about the hemorrhaging. It's just the horror of it. I hear your story. I was clearly affected. I've got a very good friend who, while she was delivering her son, you know, told me her story, and I'm sure I turned white just hearing it. There's just a terror of it. So, it's hard to believe that, and then of course, like I said, long term, father in law has on blood thinners, and they're always checking for bruises and things. I mean, there's just this seems to be. I can't imagine they're not. I can't envision a subset of healthcare, be it the patient, the clinicians, the payers. I can't see anybody not thinking this is a great idea and something that if we isn't made available to people is irresponsible. And I don't typically talk like this about technology. So it's really remarkable.
Thank you.
And that's not a question. That's just a statement. So what's the question, I guess, for me? And this has been a great conversation. What's next for you in terms of fundraising and things like that? What are you looking to next to make sure that this vision becomes a reality?
Oh my goodness. I'm really excited about this year, frankly. After our MedTech Innovator win, that was amazing. That was such a launch point for us. I cannot tell you how incredible it was. It was also completely overwhelming as a founder and a small team, the amount of interest and everything that we got after that. I mean, it was just incredible. But frankly, at the beginning of the year, we dug in as a team and we looked at all of our assumptions on our path to market. What was the product work we have to do? What is the regulatory work we do? What clinical work we have to do? And I'm so proud of my team because I feel like we have a crystal clear vision of what we're going to achieve with the capital we currently have on hand. And we are about to open up our next round. And that round is essentially going to get us through our clinical studies in preparation for our FDA submission. And so that's really the what's next. We've had a lot of fun because I've got part of my team really launching into that clinical unit development. And so we've actually taken the early prototype and made decisions that are better for us from a commercial perspective and have yielded a better device. Like the stuff we get to use right now in the commercial grade device is actually like causing us to geek out internally on some of the things that we're seeing. So that's been really cool. The other thing that we are doing, and I have a brilliant team. So Amy Smith and Chuck Adams, Jennifer Howard, they're working with me on the like commercialization piece. And we've done a ton of work on path to payment and how are we going to bridge to reimbursement and who are good customers. And I'm so excited to see that work because essentially we've mapped out the who we think would be excellent early adopters. And we're now looking at, you know, who are we bringing into these pre-FDA studies with the intent of them becoming pilot customers and then early adopters and real advocates for us in the future. And that work is going beautifully. So I'm really excited. Again, if you haven't been able to tell in this conversation, I'm a total data nerd. And I could talk ad nauseum, I won't, but about the way that we're using real data to drive that commercialization piece. It is so cool. It is so much fun. And I even built like a widget, a whole website for us to do an entire landscape analysis of every hospital system in the United States. And like color, I mean, it's just so cool, right? So I love that stuff. And then
if people can see you beaming right now. You just
I love this. I love when data brings insight. When you can really take it and it becomes clarity and vision. And I feel like that's what we've achieved over, you know, the last couple of months. And the other thing that's been beautiful, I'm very honored to work with clinicians. So we've got Dr. Keisha Callens, Dr. Ross McQuivey, who have really complementary expertise here. So Ross comes from MedTech. So he used to be CMO at Labory. And he's just got this brilliant, he was an obstetrician, an OB-GYN that went into MedTech. So he gets strategics. He gets that piece. Keisha, Dr. Callens is amazing. She is the boots on the ground. When you hear about maternity care deserts where we have like people that have to drive hours to go see an OB, she is the person. She's that OB in the state of Georgia that like goes out to meet people, right? She's the one serving all of these underserved communities. Huge advocate for maternal health, absolutely brilliant person, and a lovely human being. So we've been working together on that clinical strategy. And in my mind, if I can paint a picture of like threads weaving together, that is the way this moment feels for our company. And so that plan having become tighter and tighter and tighter and really flowing forward, we know what we're going to do with our next capital infusion. We're raising that $5 million round. I can see where it's going to get us. And it's positioning us for that commercial inflection point, which is really, I'm just excited about the work we're doing. So I know I'm rambling a bit, but if you can't tell, I think 2026 is going to be a fun year for us.
That's great. And just circling back to the pain you felt a few years ago when you were putting the business plan together and raising two kids and working a full-time job, I'm guessing it was worth it.
Yes. beyond any doubt. I mean, I love my job. I love my job. It is brutal. It is hard. It is, I have been, you know, I've had the gut punches along the way. It has been so difficult and infinitely rewarding. And the reason it's rewarding is because of the people I get to work with and the impact we're poised to make. Not a moment that I tell our story goes past that somebody doesn't walk up to me and share a deeply personal, hey, and this happened to my sister or my wife or, and yeah, I'm getting chill bumps. Like that is the why, right? That's why we do this. And that's why I love my job.
We'll end it right there. This has been a fantastic story. Thank you for being generous with your experiences and for helping to make this technology hopefully become a reality very soon. It feels very important. So thanks so much, Kelsey.
Thank you so much, Tom. This has been wonderful.
Well, that is a wrap. Thanks so much for joining us on this episode of Device Talks Weekly. I hope you'll join us at Device Talks Minnesota on May 4th. Go to minnesota.devicetalks.com to register. Please do subscribe to this Device Talks podcast, Device Talks Weekly podcast, or our Device Talks podcast network so you don't miss a future episode from any of our great podcasts. And of course, as always, we would love you to connect with us on LinkedIn, connect with me, connect with Chris Newmarker, connect with Kayleen Brown, and of course, follow Mass Device and Device Talks on LinkedIn. And that's it. That's a wrap. Thanks again. This is Tom Salemi of Device Talks. Thank you for joining us on this episode of the Device Talks Weekly Podcast.